CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 134, with Gustavo Heuning, innovating and advancing anterior and posterior segment surgery. He's a retina surgeon, cataract surgeon, and eye trauma surgeon. Let's learn more. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, a very dear friend. That is Dr. Gustavo Heuning from Brazil, Santa Maria, in fact. And Gustavo is a fantastic cataract surgeon, but also a vitreo retinal surgeon. And he's had a lot of innovation, which we're going to talk about. Gustavo, welcome to our podcast.
Welcome to cataractcoach.com. Okay, that's your line, but thank you so much for inviting me. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are, or whenever you are listening to us. It's a pleasure today. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, it was my pleasure to actually interact with you a little bit in Copenhagen at the ESCRS recently, the European Cataract Meeting. And now you are actually in Japan. And so thank you for taking time out of your crazy schedule to schedule this call with us.
No, you know, when friends invite you, it's a call, so you have to attend them. It's my real, real pleasure. Here in Japan now, related to Brazil or to you in LA, we have plus 16 hours, so I'm glad we could fit our time zones.
Right. Now, one thing that you are very good about is learning from colleagues worldwide. So I know you're involved in the European vitreoretinal schools to teach. But you're based in Brazil. I know that when you came to Los Angeles, you contacted me and we spent time together. But you have a thirst to learn from colleagues around the world. How did you develop this?
So it's a pity we just have 1 hour to talk, okay? But we could spend a week talking about it. One of the things is my greatest influence was my dad, who passed away a year ago. And my father studied abroad, okay? He lived in Argentina for 8 years. He came back, and I have a German heritage. So I was educated in German, Spanish, and Portuguese at the whole time. Wow. And we always have colleagues from abroad visiting us. My father, on those years, was able to build a nice clinic where people were interested to see. He was also a pioneer in our region in refractive surgery. And the thing is, I was always thirsty to learn different languages. I can speak almost 7. And when you go abroad, we don't have the time to do it always, but I always try to look for something or to visit a colleague, as I visited you like 2 or 3 years ago. And when I was in Copenhagen, I didn't have the chance because of lack of time. So here now in Japan, before yesterday, I went to visit a VR colleague, Dr. Yusuke Oshima. He is the father of the 27 gauge. And next week, I'll visit Dr. Takeshi Hara. He is one of the best glaucoma surgeons here in Japan. And, you know, I cannot explain, but it's something you told me this, and I love the phrase. Ophthalmology is a brotherhood because we are so small. We are innovative. We want to see what other people are doing because I can learn with you through your videos in Cataract Coach, in YouTube, Instagram, or your website. But going to visit you, to talk to you, these are the tips that you don't see in a Congress lecture or whatever. It's what we say, I don't know how you guys say in English, but the chats you have in the aisle, in the corridor, that's where you really learn with your friends.
Yeah, that's a good point. In fact, the saying is, you learn a lot in the lecture halls at the big meetings, but you really learn a lot in the hallways just catching up with colleagues. Absolutely.
That's right.
But you spend a lot of time traveling. I mean, you are learning from colleagues truly around the world.
As you say, I think the term in English for that is jet setter, right? So in the last 2 months, I had 7 meetings. I was busy. And I promised my family that for the next year, I'll try to reduce it. And my wife always tells me, just you believe in that, because each year you're doing more stuff. So you are addicted to it. You cannot. Don't promise things you cannot accomplish.
Now, one thing that's very interesting is that I can hardly even spell retina. I know very little. But you have done so much training and fellowships. Of course, you're a very noted retinal colleague, retinal expert, but also you do cataract surgery, you know, refractive surgery, glaucoma. Now you're here in Japan, you're going to learn glaucoma surgery now. So you cover the full spectrum of ophthalmic surgery.
So when I began after my residency, I was really keen into oculoplastics. I like it very, very much because of this thing of the to do the symmetric blepharoplasty, whatever. But what changed in the last decades, I would say? Knowledge became so big that you cannot be updated in all fields. So most of the time here now I'm doing VR and cataract. And I also have two younger brothers, Arthur, my middle brother, who is, we all three can do cataract, okay? Arthur does cataract and glaucoma. And Afonso, the youngest one, is doing cataract and cornea. That helped me a lot. They are back since 5 or 6 years ago. But you sometimes, when you are, because, how can I say, the VR surgeon is the firefighter in ophthalmology. You are usually right. The last line, right? Yes. So sometimes you have to do a combined surgery. So to know at least, I'm not the best glaucoma surgeon or whatever, but you have to know at least the basics. Otherwise, especially with a socioeconomic factor that must be considered in Brazil, you cannot put this patient twice in the OR, okay? Sit there and do what you have to do. And that's one thing, but we had a discussion now in the ESRS in Copenhagen. A case where a colleague was doing neovascular glaucoma cataract surgery, and it was bleeding a lot. So I went to the microphone. Usually I don't like to do it, and told him, you should have injected anti-VGF before the surgery. So again, we had a time where the subspecialties were very split. And in my humble opinion, everything's coming together again. Cataract surgeons will have to learn a lot about retina because each year we have more patients with diabetes, okay? And it's going to be a common stuff. We must know at least the basics of the other subspecialties.
I think you're totally right. You know, example I used to give is that when I was teaching my residents, and I've retired from that last couple of years, but we'd have these new cases of neovascular glaucoma, usually from untreated proliferative diabetic disease. And we would, of course, do their anti-VEGF. We'd end up taking them to the operating room. They all also had a cataract. They're 65 years old. We'll make them take out their cataract. While they're on the OR table, put the indirect laser on, do some panretinal photocoagulation. Then put the IOL in. Then put the Ahmed valve in, too. Everything all at once. One sitting.
That's it. That's perfect. That's how we should be doing it, in my opinion, okay? Sometimes you have some restrictions or you're not the best one to do it, then call a colleague, be humble, okay? We cannot know everything and we cannot do everything. Be humble and ask for help. This won't make you a worse doctor. The opposite, this will make you a better surgeon.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I tend to choose a couple things to be have very deep expertise. So for me, cataract and refractive, I want a very deep expertise. But I want to have good knowledge. Maybe not to be an absolute artist, but have a good knowledge and ability in glaucoma surgery and cornea surgery as well, of course. Because and you're right, it all comes back together.
As we say, even if we choose subspecialty, after all, we are still eye surgeons, the whole eye. So have that in mind.
No, I think that's a very good point. Now, you're there visiting a vitreoretinal colleague who developed 27-gauge vitrectomy. So explain it to a cataract surgeon like me who doesn't do parts plane of vitrectomy. Isn't that very, very low flow? I mean, isn't Poiseuille's equation 27-gauge? How much can it possibly flow?
So according to a cataract friend, this is sci-fi. This is not ophthalmology. But the thing is, we had in the past the 20 gauge, okay, before we had trochers, and the holes we were doing, the sclerotomies, were super big. So then 25 was developed, but the thing is, on the years they started with 25, the instruments were too stiff, so you could not do a decent surgery. So we gave a step back, and then we invented 23. With 23, it was one of the biggest revolutions in VR surgery, okay? And with time, physics, chemicals, with the help of the industry, we then went to 25. And now we have a lot of surgeons going with 27. Why? Because fluidics became better. The inner side of the instruments are bigger now. And you have thinner instruments, which are harder. So they don't bend while you are doing the surgery, okay?
So it's 27 gauge, but it's thin wall, larger lumen.
Absolutely, that's right. And now you can do with 27 a surgery almost in the same time you can do with a 23 gauge surgery. And wow, that has changed a lot the game. Wow. You don't have to suture. Because of that, you have less chances of a lower IOP than the following day, less chances of endophthalmitis. And this colleague, Yusuke Oshima, I've heard he has been trying 29. I don't know if it is true or not. I didn't want to ask him, but I think one day we're going to see it. The biggest challenge in the VR surgery, because more than the cataract surgeon, the VR surgeon needs a lot of instruments, okay? And they are expensive. So each time you change the gauge, the caliper of your surgery, you have to buy everything new. So we still have a lot of people still working with 23 gauge because of that, because you have to change your whole toolbox, okay? And that is expensive. We everybody know it.
No, it makes a lot of sense, for sure. Now, I also want to talk to you about something you published 10 years ago, which is when you made your own 3D viewing system. Before there were commercially available systems, you made your own 10 years ago.
Man, that's maybe one of my favorite accomplishments or stories. So this was 2012. I was still a VR fellow. And I went to a course in the Ankara University. Professor Emin Özmert was there, the big boss, the head of the department. A friend of mine, Sibel Demirel, she's now one of the best VR surgeons in the planet, was a fellow. And they had a session where they did live transmission of the surgeries in 3D. Mm. And I think 2 or 3 years before, we had Avatar in the movie theaters, which was a blast. And man, I fell in love for that. I really fell in love for that. I really wanted to do 3D surgery. I saw there was something into there. But on those years, all this equipment, 3D cameras, 3D TV, whatever, was very expensive. In Brazil, we had a lack of access to those machines. And in 2014, there was a company called TrueVision, which was bought later. So I wanted to do it. Then I go to an AAO meeting. And in the academy, I saw the first equipment in 3D, which was working. And I go back home, I tell it my father, look, we have to find a way to do it. My father says, let's try to do it, but I'm not supporting you on this crazy idea. You use your own money from your own pocket because I'm not a bank. All good. Okay. So, Uday, I spent 4 years maybe going there, asking, researching, talking to people, talking to engineers, talking to the industry people. No. Forget it. You cannot do it. But the thing is, I'm a stubborn man. And when I decide I want to do something, I'm going for it. So at the end of 2016, I go, I find an engineer. And that's funny. That's really funny. This guy was specialized in nightclubs, audio and video. Okay. He was guy putting the speakers, the lights, stroboscopic light, whatever. And I talked to this guy, look, I've talked to so many people. I don't know if you're going to understand what I want to do. These and these. I need 2 cameras. I need a 3D for flat screen. He just looked at me. You need a condenser. I look at him. I need what? A 3D condenser. That's all. You are kidding with me. You mean one machine will resolve everything? I'm going to the States tomorrow to buy it. Are you serious? Yes. And come on, no. So you buy a condenser, this, and this. So I fly to New York, I buy everything, I go back to Brazil, I call him, look, I have all the stuff here. No, but come on, I talked to you 4 or 5 days ago. Yes, and I did my job. Now it's your time. The guy comes today, and we made the first available 3D system in the Southern Hemisphere. We used it for 4 years because we had Ingenuity available here in Brazil, or we were available to buy it, okay? And the funny thing is that when my dad and my brother see it was really working and you could use it, then they wanted to be part of the team. And then I say, okay. How much do you want to pay for your share in this business? Because now it has a different price. And it was really fun, man. It was really fun. I do 100% of my cases in 3D nowadays. I think it's a one way. Sometimes people try to use it in the beginning. They don't like it, but you have to insist a little bit because you have a 55-inch screen in front of you showing you a lot of details. We have the digital filters. My middle brother, Arthur, was already with me. Before, he was still in residency. So when he had vacation, and also especially during the pandemic, they went back home. He invented the monochromatic filter. So we had a lot of colleagues who helped us on this path because you can do it alone. You have to change knowledge. And then we have different people around the world working with this. It was fun. It was really fun. Thank you for remembering me, the 3D system.
Well, it just shows you that if you have the drive, the will, the ingenuity, you can make it happen.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Of course. Well, how is the saying? Where there is a will, there is an action, or where there is a will,
there's a way.
Where there is a will, there is a way. That's it. Thank you. Thank you. So, if you want it, and we also have a saying: necessity is the mother of creativity. So, you need it, you'll find a way to do it.
Yeah, that's what you say too. Necessity is the mother of invention, is the USA, way of saying it.
Oh, the invention. Okay. Perfect. Same thing.
Now, I think 3D certainly has a role. I'll tell you, for cataract surgery, years ago, we had the system when it was commercially available, and I used it for maybe 6 months or a year, but I just found for a routine, very efficient cataract surgery, it didn't provide me with a whole lot of upside. So I stopped using it. Now I'm actually getting back into using it. Because as we develop these robotic systems, you're looking at a 3D monitor again. You're going back to it.
I'm glad to know, because when I've been visiting you 3 years ago, you told me you didn't like it. Now you're back. Once you go into 3D, man, you can't go back. It's a one-way path. So I'm glad to hear about it. And for sure, with the robotic systems, 3D is a must. I have no doubts about it. And we are still walking slowly. 3D will bring many other options, for sure about it. And I'm glad to hear about it because you are one of our, maybe the greatest influence we have in our field. It's glad to know about it. Still, the only challenge about the 3D systems are the price. They are too costly. And there was now a new 3D system in the SCRS. I was walking through the booths from a new company. They have improved the depth of field, the vision quality, and I think we're going to see in a short future, very new stuff and new applications for it, hopefully.
Yeah, one of the challenges I guess we have here, certainly in the U.S. and probably in many other countries too, is that the cost of our technologies keep getting more and more and more. But yet, if you look at like the government reimbursement for these procedures, your pay is less and less and less. It becomes quite the challenge.
This is maybe one of the greatest challenges we have in our field nowadays, as we were mentioning before, socioeconomics. I use 3D systems even in the public, because I work in private and public, okay? And I have one machine in each one. In the public system, you cannot charge more, and even if you could, those patients wouldn't be able to afford for it. But I think there is an indirect earn on it as time, as education, because your whole team is watching the same surgery. So my helpers, I don't need to talk to them. They know when it's the time to give me the new instrument, or if there is any complication, they see there is a PCR, for example, they already prepared the anterior vitrectomy without saying anything. These are the biggest indirect earns. So if you save time, for example, for me, that's an important thing. More than time worth more than money, right? And in the private system, also health insurances won't reimburse them. And sometimes if it is a case, which I think I really will need it, you can charge patients for that. But even so, if the patient says he cannot afford it, of course I'll do the surgery the same way. But innovation is really, really, really important, especially in ophthalmology. Which is, I would say we are the number one in innovation in all medical fields, right? It's really ambitious to say that. We have genetics, we have MRIs, radiology, whatever. But one of the nice things we have now in the ESCRS, I talked to Filomena, who is the president, Burkhard Dick, the vice president, Joaquin Fernandez, the secretary, and one of the heads of the scientific committee. They focused this year meeting in long-term results because there is a bias. We are talking too much on innovation and we are not paying attention. If these new innovations, this new stuff, what are the results? Are we doing better to our patients, giving a better result, or are we just innovating for innovating? So this is one thing I want to congratulate them here in public, because we really need to know the new IOL, the new machine, the new technique. How are the results in 10 years? And the ESCRS program this year, we had a lot of it. And that's one thing for the newer generations who are listening to us. I would recommend to record everything and to register everything, publish it, bring the results. We want to see how are things behaving, because otherwise we have no reference. We are just changing stuff without knowing if it works or not.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key things as we move into this, you know, next few years, is really tracking our data, the use of big data to look at actual long-term results.
Absolutely, I agree. And even with that, big data is already changing the planet and the society, the way we live. But even for people who don't have access to AI or starting or have budget restrictions, write it down. Okay, I'm starting to implant a new IOL. Okay, take note of your results. Okay, I put first negative when I do the biometry, but the result was minus 0.5 or whatever. Do your own history, develop your own constant, and register and publish. We need it, because you are going to help millions of people. Science is the way, so we can compare, we can see what if things are doing fine or not.
Yeah, I saw that feeling at the ESCRS, and what I was impressed with, it seemed like the ASCRS was kind of on the downswing. But the ESCRS every year is like better and better. That meeting is definitely on the upswing.
So, my humble opinion, I haven't been many times. Actually, this year in LA was my first time at the ESCRS. I liked it. But about the ESCRS, I can talk more, because I've been there many times. And my humble opinion, also talking about BROSCARS, the Brazilian Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery, what I can see as a pattern, they are these two societies, they are opened, and each year they open the program for more people, for younger people, and for people who are not from the big universities or big cities. They are bringing people who usually wouldn't have the chance to talk in public and bringing this knowledge, because you know it more than me. You are traveling the whole planet. Every place you go, you learn a new thing. There is a colleague who is not in the social network, who is not in meetings, who is not publishing, but these guys are good. Give them a chance. You have to oxygenate. You have to give them new air, fresh air. And I think that's the merit of the ESCRS and the BROSCARS on this subject.
Inclusive meetings, very open. You can present. You've never been to meet. Come, they'll welcome you with open arms. Absolutely.
And one thing I do like about the ESCRS, they have this instructional course where you can send. It's open. You can send it. And actually, I send a few. You can send just one. So this is one thing I would recommend they should change. Make it possible people can send more. And because if you can send just one instructional course, sometimes we have two or three good ideas and you have to choose between them. And if you don't write it down, you forget about it. So that would be my humble suggestion to them. Of course, I don't want to, we have another saying here. I don't want to teach the priest how to give the mass, right? I don't know if you have something like that, but this would be a tip. Another thing I see is that I don't know how many countries are a member of the ESCRS, but this melting pot, this cultural pot, you earn a lot. As we were saying before, the chats outside of the halls, that's one a different thing. So how are you doing cataract, or how are you getting reimbursement in Spain, in France, in Germany, in the US, in Brazil, whatever? This is something, this cultural exchange is nice.
You know, I saw a huge number of Brazilians at the ESCRS. There were for sure more Brazilians than Americans. I was amazed.
Officially, in the WhatsApp group we have from the Broskers, there were 140 in the group, but I'm sure we were around at least 200, and we had more than 30 or 40 speakers this year in the ESRS. As I told you, they are becoming more open. But it was a barbarian invasion, okay? It was a Brazilian team invading the Vikings land.
But it was fantastic learning. Well, I think the one thing that I really appreciate in learning from you and other Brazilian surgeons is that you have almost always the double exposure of a private clinic, and then you do work in the public system. You do both. I used to do that when I was professor, because the teaching hospital we were at was basically a public county hospital, almost like a charity hospital. So I would spend half my week private, half the week public. But there's such a beauty in that kind of exposure to having both.
So that's a very good question or comment, because I was talking to the Japanese colleague here, and here in Japan, you cannot. You have to choose. Or you are fully private, or you are fully public. And most of the public stuff are done inside the universities. In Brazil, we have our population now, it's around 215 million, okay? And more or less, these numbers change a little bit, okay? But more or less 70-75% of the population just have access to the public system. They cannot afford a private health insurance. And being into public, okay, if you have a good system with high volume, organized, can be a viable product, a viable clinic. And doing that, it also gives you the chance to do a lot of surgeries, okay? We have guys who are doing, I would say, 20,000 phacos per year, okay? Like in India, for example, that's a very high scale.
20,000 phacos a year is unbelievable. That's like yes. 400 a week.
That's not me, okay? That's not me. But we have people doing it, okay?
Yeah, for sure.
Sorry?
Yeah, that's amazing. That's 20,000 a year is 400 phacos a week.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, for sure. No. We have guys doing it 2,000 phacos per month because they have to take vacation. Remember that. And also, I'll give you my example, okay? Sure. When I started with VR surgery more than 10 years ago, the waiting line for a retina surgery was 3 years. Years. Yeah, in the public system. So my first 5 or 6 years, I would say, I was doing 1,000 vitrectomies per year, 80 to 100 every month.
Wow.
And that's one thing I'm really proud about it, because I had to talk to the government, to the clinics, to the local governments. And after 18 months, the waiting line got down to 15 days.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. And now with the medical stuff, with the medical inflation, things became too expensive. The government could not follow the pace of the inflation. And this is one thing now with the waiting line increased a lot as well. We don't know how to solve it. But going back to the colleagues who work in private and public, also we do have, I'll give you numbers. Last sure. year in Brazil, we performed 1.7 million cataracts in the whole country, okay? And inside from this, 0.6 million was private and 1.1 million was in the public system. So then you can have an idea. Brazil has around, I would say, 20,000 ophthalmologists. And from this number, maybe 20-25% are able to perform a cataract surgery. So then you can have an idea of the proportions. But the thing is, the incidence of cataract is much, much bigger. The demand is much bigger than the offer, okay? Every year we have more cataract cases because population is getting old in Brazil faster than we were expecting. I don't know how in the future we are going to deal with that because of the economical impacts of it, but yes, we can do it. I think countries like, besides Japan, I think in Turkey, you have to choose between private or public. And I think also that these countries will have to change because people are there, they need the cases, like in Brazil, like in America. You should be able to work wherever you're okay. It's free. It's freedom of choice. I think that's the final answer for it.
Well, I think it also, if you do both, it teaches you some very different and very valuable skills. Because sometimes the disease you see is very different. Like on the VR side, in the public system, you'll probably see a lot more proliferative diabetic disease, a lot more trauma. Whereas on the private side, you may see a lot more macular disease, puckers and membranes and things of this nature.
Totally right. Especially because since we are in the Southern Hemisphere, the colder months are May, June, July, August. Usually April, I see a lot of ocular trauma while the people are chopping wood. April, always. So I already have the organized the months, which are the most frequent diseases in every month. And April is the wood trauma because they are chopping. And I already had to try to educate them through the radio, going to meetings, organizing the health, the local health ministry, to teach them to use acrylic
glasses. And they are cheap.
Glasses. They cost like, I don't know, $5 more or less. But even so, they don't have it. They have it here in the pocket. And the thing is, it's hard to deal with patients when they just have a trauma because they are fragilized, you know, they are worried. Most of the times you won't recover all the vision in these cases.
Yeah.
And I joke with the patients, was your pocket really protected? Because your eyes, man, protect them or teach people, spread the word. That's very important.
Yeah. I mean, you do a lot of work with ocular trauma. That's for sure. You do a lot of ocular trauma work. And I think the tough part there is, you're right, you can never undo the trauma. You can never go back to perfectly normal vision.
Yes. I was talking to this colleague here and I asked him, look, you are a VR surgeon, but I know you are also a good cataract surgeon. Do you go to cataract meetings? And his answer was like, I don't go there because cataract meetings are boring. And I asked him why. And he tells me, no, because you just talk about IOL innovations. It's not my field of work. And then I told him, look, man, I agree a little bit with you, but I like the complications cases or complications management. Since the VR guy is the end of the line, that's what I do most of the time. And as you said, working in public gives you the chance to learn more because of the volume. And you can then apply that in the private systems, because even in private, we have a lot of things. I think it was in the beginning of the year, I did an artificial iris implantation. And if I didn't have the skill, if I didn't have the skills which I learned in the public, I wouldn't have been able to perform the surgery.
That's a great point. Absolutely. Now, for the rest of ophthalmology, what did you find exciting at the ESCRS that you're going to incorporate into your practice? What's coming down the road for us?
So one, I think that the most important paper in the last months was the new IOL classification, which was written by Joaquin Fernandez from Spain and many others. This is something because most of my time I worked in the public system and I'm really into the private for the last, I would say, 6 years, more or less. And the thing is, it's really challenging to learn because we are providing a service, okay? Right. How do you teach or how do you say what's the best way to teach a patient that a trifocal IOL will make his life better or even a toric IOL will make his life better, because these IOLs, they are more expensive than a regular monofocal, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how can I say, I don't like the word, but I think I'll make a point and you will understand. How do you sell it? How do you preach to this patient about it? Because you know that will make his life better, but on the other way, he'll have to spend more money with that. And sometimes people cannot, sometimes they can. So that's one thing that I'm still learning to do it, because we, and I think there is a bias in our education right today, that we are we have to provide health, whatever, I think that's nice. But we also have bills to pay, right? And we are not doing harm. The opposite, we are improving their lives. So for me, that's the main issue and something I'm still trying to do to learn in meetings. How do you talk to a patient when you want to provide him with a better IOL? You maybe is one of the best people we have in the planet to talk about it, because I know your volume and your expertise in this field is very huge. So for people who are starting in the private system, that's a big goal.
Yeah, and it's sometimes not easy, because sometimes we want to try to make the patient into a junior ophthalmologist, which really is a big challenge, because remember, these patients may have expertise in something else like law or accounting or business, and they have no knowledge of optics. And so trying to explain this is really just probably futile. I think the thing that I do in my clinic is I explain to the patients ahead of time. We send them a video. Here are what some of the options are, but we'll talk about them in person. And then I give the patient a specific recommendation. So I'd say, based on your anatomy, your measurements, your eyes, and your needs for your vision, as per this questionnaire we've done and our discussions, the best choice lens for you is this one, period. And so then you'll know, then the patient, because here's what I take a step back and I think, I went to medical school. I mean, I know a thing or two about, you know, medicine, but if I had to have a hip replacement tomorrow and the orthopedic surgeon says to me, okay, do you want this titanium one? I've got the ceramic one. I've got the Teflon one. I've got the fenestrated one. I don't know. Look at my hip. Here are my activities. Look at my CT scans. You tell me what's best for me. So I kind of think of the same way for patients for ophthalmology. Let me tell you what's the best IOL for you. And if you are an easygoing person who's very artistic and you have pretty bad cataracts, let's say 20 out of, you know, 100 cataracts, and you're a +2 hyperope, well, you're going to love me if I put a trifocal lens in. You will be amazed. But if you're a -2 myope, who's presbyopic, but it has no cataracts, and you put a trifocal lens in me, I'll become more crazy. I'm already crazy. I'll become even more crazy. So it just kind of, that's why the easy way is for the patients, you as a surgeon, give them your expertise. Because your expertise is not just doing the surgery. It's giving your surgical judgment ahead of time. And I think that's what's most important. And this, you know what, the same thing applies in retina surgery. If I go tomorrow and I have an attachment, some peripheral small attachment, and I go see a retina colleague, and the retina colleague says, no, you know what, you need to do a pneumatic. Or he says, no, you need a buckle. You need a vip. Whatever you think I need, fix me, do it. Whatever it is, I trust your judgment.
And you touched the point, because usually the barrier is not the patient. The barrier is here inside. That's right. The greatest challenge. That's the greatest challenge, because we feel so sorry that maybe we are charging them, whatever. And you touched the point. You are the one. We are not charging just for the surgery. You are charging for all the assistance we give. When it starts, when the patient enters the door, until then, when he leaves at PO30. That's it.
Right. No, for sure. Absolutely. And listen, I don't know any of us who are in medicine for money. If I wanted to make a ton of money, I should have gone into investment banking or real estate or private equity or VC funds, not treating patients one eye at a time. At the end of the day, we work with our hands. We're no different than the guy chopping the wood or the carpenter making, sure, you know, working in the carpentry shop. We're the same. We work with our hands.
Totally agree. 100%. 100%. We are providing a service.
You know, what I liked a lot, the ESCRS now has this official kind of classification system for IOLs. And I think it's so helpful because there were a time, remember, the companies, ophthalmic companies, were very thankful that they give us great innovations. But they're also in the business of marketing. And so sometimes they're over-marketing their lens to promise something that is maybe not quite delivering. So when they say in the ESCRS guidelines, no, the EDOF lens provides at least 1.5 diopters of range. That's a concrete number, and I like it. That was great.
We need a reference, and we need all to be speaking the same language, as you tell you, because they put a fancy and nice name, which is really easy to sell. We remember it. But we know, okay, how much is the addition, how it works, it is diffractive, it is refractive, what else? Teach me, because I'm not implanting a device that I cannot understand.
Of course. That obviously makes the most sense. You know what helped me the most in thinking about any IOL? I always think the amount of photons of light entering your eye is fixed. Spread them however you wish. But you can't spread them thinner or over a wider range without having impact on image quality. You can't.
Absolutely. So teach me, how many percent of this light is going for near, for mid, for far? And teach us. One thing that would be nice, we already have this, when you go to the supermarket and you look on the backside and you have the nutrition data of food. We should have something like that for IOLs.
Oh, I love that idea. That's a great idea. So here is the light distribution of this lens, period.
I mean, the light distribution, the addition, the constant, because usually the A constant is a small number. You have to check where is it. Usually it takes us 10 seconds to find it. So put on the back of the package the data and let us choose.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Hopefully we'll get there. But I think the ESCRS has got a great first step in achieving this, of having very concrete guidelines for IOL classification. I think it makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yes. And I think the first thing is now resident services teach that for the new young doctors, because the names change a little bit, and it will take us a few months to learn it properly and apply it in our offices as well.
For sure. I mean, and obviously this all ends one day in the future when we have that truly accommodating IOL that restores us back to, you know, 8 diopters of accommodation. Then we don't have to worry anymore.
true. No discussions about it.
except the cost of that one's going to be sky high. It's going to be crazy.
Absolutely. Let me ask you one thing. How many travels are doing per year?
Last year I did 21 countries. This year I'll probably do 23 countries.
Wow. So how many years does your passport, how every ounce you have to change your passport?
So actually I just got a new passport about a year ago, and you can order it with extra pages. So for someone who travels a lot.
Oh, I didn't know it. I didn't, because let me know you. My passport, it still has 2 blank pages. Probably I'll finish it this year or in the next months, but I just learned something new. I'll ask for that.
Yeah, in the US you can. So in the US, usually you can order it ahead of time, but even if your passport's running out, you can get extra pages added to it. So normally in the US, the passport was like pages 1 through like 24. And then if you add extra pages, in the middle, they put in pages A through like W. They double the thickness of it.
Nice.
But I ordered this
time. Thank you.
I ordered a bigger passport right off the bat. But you know, a lot of countries now aren't even stamping it. Right? You can travel from one place in the EU to another place in the EU. No one's checking anything. Just walk in. So
that's it. But one thing I wanted to, so going back to the beginning of our conversations, one thing that I see which is different in America, and you have people from the whole planet watching your channel, this podcast, you guys have very well divided. You have to choose into cataract or into VR surgery. You cannot do both. And most of the countries, like here, Japan, or my home country, Brazil, or Europe, we are able to do both of stuff.
Right.
And one thing, I don't know which one is better, if it's a market reserve or how it works, but what's your opinion on it? I know you are the one interviewing here, but that's something I have always wanted to ask, and now it's a good time for that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, the U.S. system is everyone does an ophthalmology residency, and then after that, you can subspecialize. There are now cataract refractive fellowships. You can do a cornea fellowship, a glaucoma fellowship, a pediatric strabismus fellowship, and then the two longer, those are all 1 year. The two-year fellowships are vitreoretinal surgery, although you could do just a one-year medical retina fellowship, which is non-surgical. But then the other one is oculoplastics and orbit surgery. Is usually a two-year fellowship as well. So in these, in the U.S., there's enough specialists, we have enough ophthalmologists that you can have someone specialize in jet BR surgery. So in like here in Los Angeles, I don't know any vitreoretinal surgeon who routinely does cataract surgery. They're just so busy with vitreoretinal work. And it's also, they're also referral type practices. So very few people just decide, I'm going to call up, you know what? I want to see a retina doctor. They end up getting referred to the retina specialist, usually from their general ophthalmologist or their anterior segment surgeon, or maybe even their optometrist. So it's a little bit different here. But yeah, I don't know, in the U.S., it's very different compared to other countries where you'll have, like you, a VR surgeon who still does cataracts. The nice part, though, about just ultra-specializing is I can have a really deep expertise. And I'm so happy to have a patient who has a retina problem to refer it out. There's such a great colleague who's an amazing retina surgeon only. So I think it helps at the end of the day. I mean, similar, if you look at something even more complicated, I don't want to do anything to do with the orbit. I just don't.
Right.
That should be an orbital surgeon, oculoplastics trained. That's for you. I have no interest in this. And yeah, same with you can do a strabismus. You can do a strabismus surgery. It's very hard, very easy. To do a R&R of a muscle is very easy. Muscle surgery is not difficult. To be competent, but to be an artist and to know how to exactly put the muscle, exactly titrate,
that's tough.
Right. So I think the advantage of being super specialized is you get to be an absolute artist at that one field.
Yeah, I'm asking you because we are finishing to build a wet lab center here, and that's a place where which was my father's dream. And since I told you he passed away a year ago, we stopped the project. But now we are finished. It'll have five places with microscopes, phaco machines, and then people will have the chance to perform hands-on surgery. And I'll be teaching them the whole time with my brothers. And one of the questions I got, and now I've been thinking about it, because we have a cataract fellowship and we have also a retina fellowship. And I was challenged, I would say. Why do I not create an eye surgery fellow combining cataract and retina, especially considering trauma situations? But I don't know if you have to learn both. Of course, if it is better if you know both. But a surgical eye fellowship with two together would be something new, which I'm still not sure how I should organize that program. Because, you know, when we are teaching, we have a big responsibility, a very big one, because people are spending, I would say better, they are investing their time and their hopes on you. So that's something I'm still thinking about it, but I might try to do it the next year. Let's see how it goes. That was the purpose of my question, and you gave me some ideas about the super specializing thing in each subspecialty.
But I think it's also a little different. I think, so I'm cataract with a refractive focus, and I'll tell you, 100% of the residents who I trained in the past who went into vitreoretinal surgery were fantastic cataract surgeons. Every retina surgeon I refer patients to here in LA, and I have a core group of a handful of these amazing surgeons, they are fantastic VR surgeons, but they were also amazing cataract surgeons. But what they haven't kept up on, they have the amazing skills. They can chop that nucleus, do a beautiful Rexus, the works. but they don't keep up on the refractive component of it. Honing the astigmatism treatment or doing this new, you know, type of EDOF lens, that's not interesting to them. They're going to put a monofocal lens in, and they're not super concerned with the refractive component. But technically, they are fantastic surgeons. So I think your type of fellowship where you're doing, basically you're doing the whole eye, anterior segment and posterior segment, especially involving trauma, which as we know, trauma often involves both anterior and posterior segment. So you want to be able to have that amazing skill set. And I think here in the US, the retina surgeons that I refer to certainly have both anterior and posterior skills. Fantastic.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's the idea, because the clinic which we have focused on the public system, we have traumas every day, every day. And it will be a nice chance. This could be a new kind of fellowship, a trauma one. And having the wet lab structure, which is we called it Mistral, Microsurgery Training Lab is the name, would be a nice chance to share this knowledge so they can use it, they can train it. And let's see, when you come to visit me, you are always invited to come here. I'm going to show you and you're going to bring some nice ideas. I know you're coming in, what, 1 or 2 months to Southern Brazil? So we are eager to have you here there.
I'm coming for 2.5 days to Porto Alegre. That's it.
Okay. In and out. Okay, let's make the best of it.
No, absolutely. But I think, yeah, what you're offering there is super, super valuable.
Yes.
In the U.S., in the U.S., the biggest change we have in retina, actually, the last 20 years, there's a huge growth in medical retina fellowships. So a one-year term where they're learning basically non-surgical retina. So essentially here in the U.S., they'll be doing all the intravitreal injections and doing medical monitoring of and treatment of disease, but not necessarily doing any type of surgery, especially not any vitreoretinal retinal surgery. So there is that differentiation now.
Yes, absolutely. I would say the medical retina field, right? You get a little bit of uveitis for sure. We are living the golden age of the macular diseases. Until we had Avastin, we would say to our patients, good luck.
Right.
Now we can treat them. And especially now with genetics, the medical retina field is changing totally. It's a new specialty. We already have medical retina specialists focused in genetic diseases. And now that we are starting to have these new treatments, this is also a hot stuff now. If I were finishing my residency, I would strongly think about it, because we just have a few people who are really good in this field. And eye genetics is something, we had the first genetic therapy was Luxturna, right? And yep. We are going to see new stuff, because after the pandemics, all the research money is going back to their places, because we had all the industry focusing in the COVID solution. Now everything is stabilized again, and we are opening new fields like that. So for younger people who are watching us, think about it.
Yeah, it's a great time to be a young ophthalmologist. If you're getting into ophthalmology now, wow, you're getting in at a great time. The future is incredibly bright.
And even people, if you are bored with your own field, think about it.
About switching over. I mean, the problem is that it's become super competitive. Here in the U.S., I think it's very challenging to match in the ophthalmology. So it's very, very much in demand. So
Brazil as well. Usually ophthalmology in Brazil is one of the top five.
Yeah, I think it's kind of becoming that way worldwide. I think the secret is out. Ophthalmology is a really an amazing field. And as you said, there's so much innovation. I think of any medical field, it really is towards the very top in just cutting edge innovation.
Yes, yes. And another thing, which I think is also a nice tip, I'm an invited staff in the Federal University in São Paulo in the surgical optics department. And being linked to the academy is really, really, really important. You don't need to be as active, but you are in touch with people who are doing the research or the professors, whatever. It helps you to keep updated much better. Also, Another very, very important thing. I have written an article for the Broskers magazine 2 years ago. The internet has changed the axis of power. Until the 90s, we had big professors who were the owners of the knowledge, and what they used to say in a meeting or in public was law, and they could finish a career. Now with this, we change it totally. You, and this is something I was telling to the Broskers organizers and also to other meetings organizers, to the SRS people. You don't need to go to a meeting to be updated or to learn. If they publishes now something in LA, a guy in Indonesia, a guy in Japan, a guy in Brazil can see, have access to the same information in the same moment. So why do we need what, which is the purpose of the society's existence? I would say they are curating the knowledge. I don't know if this is the proper word for that. Like if you go to a museum, and the purpose of the societies is to organize this information, to tell me, because we are all busy, we don't have the time. So Gustavo, today you should read this article because this one is good. Or if you are in a different field, you should read that article or that work because it's a different stuff. So societies are also reshaping the way they behave or why they should be existing or why should we still paying them to be there or to be present. So information, the way we have it nowadays, and thanks to people like you, for example, with your channel, it changed totally. We should have that in mind.
Yeah, it's a new world. I think we, at meetings, what I get the most out of it is seeing colleagues, the social aspect of it, the discussions in the hallway, and actually, it's the discussions on the podium, the interaction between panelists, or maybe even audience and speaker interaction. That's probably the most useful. Now, those interactions are a little bit more challenging when I post a video online, but the growth of this is spectacular. I mean, my Instagram is now 1.2 million views a month.
Oh,
Insta alone. Congratulations. It's crazy. Like, I'll put a video on Instagram, in 24 hours, 30,000 people will see it. A surgical video. So it's not patients watching it. This is colleagues. And then you add in the YouTube views and the cataractcoach.com views and the LinkedIn and the Facebook, and you're looking at like 4 million views a month. It blows my mind. But the nice part now is it's actually real-time peer review. I can put something up online and I can get replies and responses from many ophthalmologists instantly.
Yes. That's the thing. That's the best peer review you could ever have, because they don't owe you anything. They say what they want, what they do believe, and you can take it in a good way or in a bad way. It's such a few. As if you're a smart person, you'll take it in a good way and you'll learn from it and get better from it.
Right.
So that's the best thing about it, in my humble opinion. These things, like, we are, that's what you're doing now. This is the best thing about connecting people and learning from each other.
Oh, I think so too. And I got to tell you how much I really value our friendship. I really do. And when you came to LA, it was my pleasure to host you and just stay in my house. I was just so, and just, you know what, spending the time with you together, I learned just so much. It's such an amazing exchange there. So again, I want to thank you. I can't believe we've been talking for 1 hour. I got to be respectful of your time since you are actually in Japan, 16 hours time difference.
My pleasure. It's been an honor to be in there with you, to be invited. I know how important this is. Actually, I am the one who wants to thank you for your cataract coach, because I'm going to tell you something. My biggest challenge when I decided that I wanted to enter the cataract field, my biggest challenge was doing a Rexis, and I couldn't start the flap. And because of your tip and in your website, I learned a lot and I became a better surgeon. So thank you for the work you have been doing and teaching us.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. I have to get you to submit a video now for our sister channel, retinarounds.com. We have a nice sister channel.
Okay, let's do it. I'll be
honest. Again, I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new Cataract Coach podcast every single week on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. And of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day, 2,700 videos and counting. Next year, we're going to hit 3,000 videos. And of course, we have our sister channel, retinarounds.com. Check it out. So until next time, I'll catch you later.